Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Gina Bellaria, and I am a former Lit and Program Director here at the Commonwealth Club, Manager of Communications at California Forward, and lecturer at San Francisco State. It is my pleasure tonight to introduce Irvin Ungar to you, founder and CEO of Historicana and curator for the Arthur Schick Society. Mr. Ungar is a former rabbi and specialist in historic Judaica. He has spent many years as an art dealer and antiquarian bookseller. In 1987, he established Historicana, a rare book and manuscript firm in Burlingame, which specializes in the artwork of early 20th century artist Arthur Schick. He buys and sells rare works emphasizing historic Judaica as well, but as curator for the Arthur Schick Society, he's curated and consulted for dozens of exhibitions of Schick's art, including at the Library of Congress, at the Spertus Museum, and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. He has also written and edited numerous publications on Arthur Schick, including the book Justice Illuminated, The Art of Arthur Schick, which was came out in 1998, and the luxury limited edition of the Schick Haggadah came out in 2008, and we have some of his books over there. He served as the lender and consultant for the recent Legion of Honor exhibition, which if you haven't gotten a chance to see it yet, sure it would be a very worthwhile thing to go do, Arthur Schick, Miniature Paintings and Modern Illuminations. It is my pleasure tonight to welcome to you Irvin Ungar.
Is the mic on? Can you hear me okay? So I'm not quite sure. When people clap after the introduction, are you clapping for the person who's just given the introduction or the person who's about to speak? Both? Okay, great. Well, I haven't earned your applause yet, so we'll wait and see. Can I just see by a raise of hands, prior to the exhibition at the Palace of the Legion of Honor of Arthur Schick that was just held a number of months ago, how many people had heard of Arthur Schick? Would you raise your hand? One, two, three. Okay, about four. So, I'm going to tell you why I think he's the most famous unknown artist. That will be part of my objective tonight. But first, I'd like to begin just with a brief story about a little girl who was in the classroom and she was spending some time drawing. And, of course, the teacher was giving the presentation and she was distracting the teacher. So the teacher went over to the little girl and asked her, can you please tell me, what are you doing there? And she says, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher turned to her and said, you know, no one knows what God looks like. And the little girl says, well, when I finish this drawing, everybody's going to know what God looks like. Well, when I finish my presentation, I hope everybody here will know who Arthur Schick was and exactly what he looked like. A brief chronology of his life before I delve into his art. I'll try to do this just in a few minutes so you have an overview. Arthur Schick was born in Lodz, Poland in 1894. Lodz is a little bit west of Warsaw, and he died in the United States in New Canaan, Connecticut in 1951, only 57 years old when he died. He came to America in 1940. As a child, it's said that he was doing drawings of the Boxer Rebellion in China when he was only 6 years old. How a young Jewish boy somewhere in the middle of Poland knows about the Boxer Rebellion in China, I have no idea, except that it is said that even at age 10 or 11, he was kicked out of a trade school because he was drawing pictures of the Tsar, Russia at that time controlling Poland, and Schick was expelled from school, again, for another political drawing. So politics and drawings, maybe he didn't understand what politics were at a young age, but he certainly was a political artist from his earliest years. And when he was a teenager in 1909, 1910, his parents sent him off to Paris, where he studied for a few years in the Academie Julienne. Some of you might be familiar with Diego Rivera, who was a student of Arthur Schick at the same time at the Academy. Records recently reveal that during this two-year period, Arthur Schick went to class about 12 times within a two-year period. Where he learned all of his knowledge, it will be your guess as well as mine after you see this presentation as to how a single person could amass the amount of knowledge which he did. Schick returned to Poland in 1912. 1914, he took a brief trip to the Near East. He was in Istanbul and spent most of his time in Palestine. While he was there, World War I broke out. Schick was conscripted into the Russian army. He served in the Russian army, but happily he fled and went back to Lodz. That's how he survived. After the war, Poland was at war with the Soviet Union, and Schick became the director of art propaganda for Poland in its war against the Bolsheviks. That war ended. Schick settled in Paris. He had numerous one-man art exhibitions in Paris in the 1920s, illustrated many fine books. In the late 1930s, Schick continued his work both primarily in Paris and traveled through Poland, visited the United States, England. 1940, after the war breaks out, Schick comes to America. I'll tell you more about that, of course, and dies in 1951 in New Canaan, Connecticut. That's a brief outline. Now I'm going to try to fill it in through his art. Are you with me so far? Great. Okay. So welcome to the world of Arthur Schick. On the far right, you see something that could have been done, you know, hundreds of years ago, and by a 16th century scribe. On the far left, you're seeing an illuminated text, words of Thomas Jefferson, a political statement here on the left, if you will, and on the right, that of a work of art that could have been done by a monk poring over his manuscript. Let's take a look at the first one here, the scribe. This was painted by Arthur Schick in 1927 in Paris. This is not a self-portrait of Schick, but it is definitely a statement that he wants to make. Actually, there are numerous statements here. So I'd like to unravel some of them for you and decode this, if I may. First, you'll see the scribe is here. He's got a pen here in his hand. It's a medieval Renaissance garb, but he has a modern pen. This is not a quill. Over here, you're finding a 16th century German tapestry, but at the same time, you're seeing here a modern airplane, a train, and transportation. It's almost as if the 20th century, according to Schick, is bumping up against the Renaissance. You're seeing an illuminated, you're seeing a 16th century tapestry. By the way, this tapestry is not a real German tapestry from the 16th century. It's Schick's 20th century 16th century tapestry. It's his creation. And right next to it, you see a Picasso here. This is a Picasso self-portrait, by the way, which Schick has signed over here, Picasso. This is not by Picasso. This is Schick's Picasso. And Schick and all of the art which you're going to see here, none of it is abstract. And Schick is showing us here, subtly, I think, is that if he wanted to do abstract art, he could. If he wanted to do a Picasso, he could. I'm not saying that Schick could perform every Picasso that's being shown in San Francisco now, but I'm giving you some insight into the possibilities that if he wanted to put his mind toward creating works of art in any area, he could. This is above the Picasso here, you're seeing two cherubs who are holding up the almighty dollar. Now, keep in mind that this is 1927 Paris. He's from Poland, and he's painting the U.S. dollar bill being held aloft by two cherubs irreverently smoking pipes. These are Schick's self-portraits here that are on the two children here as they hold up the dollar bill and with one foot hold up the Picasso. And here you see a text here at the bottom. It's entirely in German. It's not written by any German philosopher. It's actually Schick's philosophy, in which he's asking us, the viewer, to come to terms with modernity as it bumps up against the values of the past. I suppose if he were painting something like this now, he might ask us to take a look at our lives and how we're being affected by the technological world and revolution in which we are. Here in 1927, he's asked us to contemplate the world as it is, as he sees it in his own time, while a gesture sort of couches in the bottom right behind skull. Nothing lasts forever, and so the mortality of all of us sets in, so let's make use of our time the best we can. And Chick, of course, is not rejecting modernity. He's just asking us to contemplate what it means as we move into it. Whereas here, on the other hand, we're seeing another piece on the opposite end of the spectrum, if you will, in terms of moving into the realm of political art, for which Schick was known primarily when he had come to America in 1940. You see an illumination here of Thomas Jefferson, in which Schick illuminates a statement written by Thomas Jefferson to Dr. Benjamin Rush after the American Revolution. "I've sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man." And so what you're seeing here is Schick loved the American presidents. He loved George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. He illustrated Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. But it was Jefferson, Lincoln, and Washington that were among his favorites. You see, this was painted by Schick in 1951, which was the very last year of his life. And I suspect that this was Schick's mantra from the very beginning, from the time his heart beat and he could think. I believe this was really part of his very essence and his soul. Here he has painted a symbol of a World War II soldier, a GI who's slaying the dragon. Here it would have been the Nazi dragon. Sort of the idea of St. George slaying the dragon, the symbol of good triumphing over evil. Schick loved two things, art and history. These were his two passions, and so I'd like to take a look now at his Visual History of Nations series. These are four works of a series of nine countries for which Schick was commissioned to create frontispieces for stamp albums, so that if you were a collector of stamps of Canada, this would have been the title page of your Canadian stamp album, or Poland, or the United States, or Israel. Again, he only completed nine countries before he died. Each of them were to highlight the various contributions that each country has made to world civilization. And so, while you'll see Chopin here, and you know, in France, which is not here, you'll see Louis Pasteur, and in the United States, he'll show you the Industrial Revolution symbolized by the steamship and the steam engine here, the Hoover Dam, the great cities of San Francisco and New York. But I want you to pay attention to this. He also highlights the contributions made by the soldier. Here you have on the sailor, the soldier. More remarkably than all of this is the two figures that he chooses to highlight here. It may be difficult for you to see there, but here in 1945, Schick has painted the Native American and the African American as part of the fabric of America as he sees it. Only being an immigrant here, having arrived here in 1940, in 1945 when he painted this, Schick saw the essence and makeup of America, also including its minorities, among them the Native American and the African American. So this was an artist who always believed that art is not my aim, it is my means. And Schick frequently said this throughout his lifetime. And he gravitated toward that of illuminated manuscripts and not abstract art, because you could deliver a message. If you're illuminating a text or an idea, you could be very clear in what you wanted the audience to see and to view and to feel. And so Schick created these illuminated manuscripts not as someone in the Middle Ages who would have been commissioned to create illuminated manuscripts. When these people created them, they were commissioned by someone who was well-to-do, who could had their full wine cellar and their servants and their chateau and all their rooms, and they used their money to create beautiful manuscripts. They'd go to a scribe or to an artist, and they would create it for themselves or their family. Schick created illuminated manuscripts for reproduction, for the masses. So these were reproduced as lithographs and distributed by the man who had commissioned him. So he would spend so much time, so painstakingly so, involved in the details for something that was to be reproduced and mass distributed. When Schick appeared for an exhibition in 1940 in Canada, before he came to the United States, the consul of Poland in Canada said about that exhibition that when studying the beauty and the greatness of Arthur Schick, you will have sight of the inner world of the artist. You will learn of his amazing knowledge of the history of nations, races, and personalities, of his meticulous thoroughness, of his nature, and last but not least, of the spirit which has animated his works. When he came to America in 1940, he came here with a price tag that had been placed on his head by Adolf Hitler for the anti-Nazi art that he was creating in Germany at the time. Schick arrived in London from Poland in 1937 with his wife and daughter for the purpose of supervising the printing of one of his books called The Passover Haggadah. And during that time, from 1937 to 1940, while he supervised the printing of this book, he was also creating anti-Nazi caricatures and cartoons that were appearing in newspapers. And so he came to America in 1940. He was known at the time, arrived here, and magazines and newspapers would write about him as a man who was a one-man war against Hitler. Here you see Arthur Schick sitting on his balcony in Manhattan. He lived on Riverside Drive. Here he is overlooking the river. Arthur Schick fights the dictators with pen, brush, and venom. This appeared in Click magazine in 1942. And then his art was constantly on the front covers of leading magazines. Here you see several of the covers that he did for Collier's magazine. As it turns out, at the time that Norman Rockwell was illustrating the covers of the Saturday Evening Post in the 40s, 50s, and thereafter, Schick was illustrating the covers for Collier's magazine, and his work was appearing on the covers for almost every event that wanted to be commemorated. I'm not showing you here, but for the first anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, it was Arthur Schick's art on the cover. For the Labor Day issues of Collier's, it was Schick's art, and you'd see other covers here as well. It's not art that he created for the purpose of matching to the colors of the sofa in your living room. This was art that was created to agitate, to move, to stir, to get people to respond, to get them particularly to respond to the Nazi threat that faced the world and America in the 1940s and the free world. On the far right, you see a historic poker game that's taking place between Hitler and Ivan of Russia. Hitler holding in his hand three jokers. Who are the jokers? You can't see them from there, but they're Mussolini of Italy, they're Hirohito of Japan, and they're Pétain of the Vichy French. Those are his jokers. Those are his wild cards. While the Russian here is holding in his hands his two cards, which are symbolizing America and England. Schick is showing you, for those of you who have ever played poker or you know people play cards, if I'm holding three of a kind in my hand and you're holding two of a kind in your hand, who wins? Me. I have three of a kind. Schick is saying that's not the case in this poker game. What he's saying is, and by the way, when he creates this cover for Collier's in 1941, he paints this in September of 1941, America is not even in the war yet. And what Schick is showing you here is that it's not possible for three jokers or three wild cards to defeat a pair of aces here. Because jokers, wild cards, you never know what they're going to do. So with a pair, Schick is placing his bets on Ivan of Russia. How do you know that? Because you see the stack of chips in front of Ivan here? They're far higher than the stack of chips that are in front of Hitler. So Schick is betting on the Russian. Americans are not in the war. They're not part of, but they are sending military equipment and gold to the Allies to support them in their effort. And then America, of course, enters the war in December. But this gives you an idea of what he's trying to create in his art when he's doing it, as he's creating it. De Profundis, another work which Schick created during World War II, Out of the Depths. It's based on Psalm 130, which is very important to both Jews and Christians and used in their liturgy. Here you have lifeless and dying Jews who are below here and pointing up to the idea of Cain. Where is Abel, thy brother? Who is going to accept the responsibility for what's taking place here during World War II? And if Schick was fighting actually two wars, and he saw himself as a one-man army against Hitler. He saw himself as a soldier in art for the Allies. And he also saw his responsibility to try to rescue and call attention to what was happening to the Jews of Europe at the time. This is a very important piece. I guess it's profound in nature by virtue of its title, but also by way in which Schick goes into great detail, as if to show us the idea that When he paints this, you'll see he's even painted Jesus here holding the Ten Commandments, as if to say, were Jesus alive in 1943, he would too have been killed with his people and been murdered by the Nazis. This work was finished by him, and what happened to it after he completed it? Well, it appeared full page in the Chicago Sun newspaper. Here are the details, again, as you saw from the full painting. And here you find the D of De Profundis. You'll find the angel of death here and the reaper here. You'll find Job here from the Bible saying the words, Eli, Eli, my God, why have you forsaken me? The same words Jesus recited, very last words that were recited by Jesus. Chick was fully aware of the meaning of the story on numerous levels for various peoples. And within the Sea of Cain, he paints a swastika here. And within the A of Abel, he paints the Star of David. And this work then was published full page in 1943 in the Chicago Sun. Huge, like this. I forgot to mention that the original work of art is only this size. And so if Schick had painted this work the size of Picasso's Guernica, I think so many of us would know who Schick is today. His works were small. They were miniature. This work appeared full page, 1943. Who sponsored it? Who paid for it? It was not paid for by any Jewish group. It was paid for by a Christian group. It was paid for by a Christian textbook commission, a Protestant group in America, who wanted to call attention to the fact that over the centuries, anti-Semitism has been taught and has been actually taught in some of the Christian textbooks that they wanted to call attention to that were in America at that time. And so Schick's art was used to call attention to what anti-Semitism can do on a grand scale, such as this work of art, and on a small scale where hatred and bigotry is taught in any way. Schick was fascinated by Wagner, but he hated Wagner. He hated hate. Schick was a hater of hate, and he created a whole series called The Nibelungen Ring. This is one of these works, Valhalla, where you find the head of the gods, Wotan, here sitting at the table. German militarism abounds here. Schick has put swastikas all over everything. As Kaiser Wilhelm and Bismarck sit here at the table also with Wotan here. At the same time, you'll find Schick has painted here Hitler serving up to all of those gathered not in Valhalla for Schick. They're actually gathered in a beer hall because this is where National Socialism got its start. This is where the raving lunacy of the National Socialists began. And so Schick paints Hitler here serving up the beer, Mussolini here bringing on a pig, Goering over here, the head of the Luftwaffe appearing in a tuxedo serving, while Goebbels, the minister of propaganda, is serving sausages to all of them serving here at the table, while Wotan's foot is on great literature here, Enlightenment, which the Nazis wish to stomp out, and his other foot is there not on a bear rug, but on a Jew rug. Schick showing you that this is what German militarism had in store at that time. This was reproduced in Cosmopolitan magazine during the war years for people to see, and also had a wide distribution in other places as well. Here you see another ally of the Nazis. This is the Vichy French, and of course, where would Schick choose to put the French? But here, right here in the kitchen. Here you have the music here is all accurate. It's all from the Nibelungen Ring, and Schick would have been very familiar with that. By the way, he did play a piano. He didn't really play it with music, and he loved to sing in numerous languages, French, Polish, Yiddish, English, and his most favorite song was Forever Playing Bubbles. And here you see some of the details in the piece here. Conscience is a Jewish invention, something Hitler would have said, and Schick put it up here on the wall. Again, some of the details of the piece. There's a message in every one of these works that are delivered. These are part of a series of allies of America during World War II. Russia and one of its heroes from the 17th century, Peter the Great. France with one of its heroes, Joan of Arc, And King Yagyiwu, again, 15th century figures. It's hoped that the allies of America at that time would look to their heroes of the past, and so Schick paints each one of them within the context of a World War II battle scene, taking history, bringing it into the present. Here you find Joan of Arc. There's a Nazi there's a serpent down here. You can't see the swastikas on its back. All the language here that Schick has written, it was difficult, again, to see, but all the symbolism. Here you see Peter the Great within the context of the Battle of Stalingrad taking place right here. The only one that's missing is England, and I don't know where the original art is for that, but Schick also painted Queen Elizabeth of England. And here you see two scenes of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. It took place in 1943. The repulsed attack here on the left, highly detailed. And also while the war was going on, Samson in the ghetto. Why Samson in the ghetto? Because in the Bible, Samson's up against the Philistines. He has no chance against them. And before he dies, he's going to take as many Philistines with him as he could. The Jews who were in the Warsaw Ghetto, the hundreds who were there who chose to revolt against the Nazis, had no other choice. They could only choose how they were going to live and now how they were going to die. And so they became heroic. Schick celebrated that heroism because he felt that people should not be victims. He felt that people should be heroic. And so he emphasized that by entitling this uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto as Samson in the Ghetto. I want to call your attention to the fact that and while the central figure is holding up the orders to liquidate the ghetto, Schick around the border here actually dedicates this to the German people. Sons of Cain, be ye damned forever and ever. Amen. This is 1945 when he paints this. If I have time later in the question and answer period, I will tell you about an exhibition of Schick's works of art that took place a few years ago in Berlin. And I went back I'm working on a documentary film about Schick, and we had German high school students come to see Schick's art, and we stood in front of this painting, and I'll tell you what their reaction to that was if we get a chance in the question and answer period, because how an exhibit of Schick's art ever took place in Germany is a fascinating story in its own right. And that was in 2008, but time doesn't permit me to do it, tell you the story right now. But Schick loved the three countries in his lifetime. He loved Poland, the land of his birth. He loved Israel, the land of his people. And he loved America, the land of his ideals. These two works of art celebrate the contributions that Poles made to America. In 1938, while living in London, Schick completed a series of 23 paintings called the Polish-American Fraternity Series. And here are two of those heroes who contributed to the well-being and the security and the birth of America. On the far right, you see Pulaski, Kazimierz Pulaski, who was the head of the cavalry under George Washington. And here on the left, you see the head of the artillery, who was a genius of military warfare. This is Kosciuszko. If you're from New York, you'll know of bridges and highways and byways that are named for these gentlemen. But here you'll see that, as I showed you, you know, of Joan of Arc and Peter the Great and King Jagiełło of Poland, I showed you World War II battle scenes that were behind them. Here you see with Pulaski here, also a battle scene, the Battle of Savannah. But look, Kosciuszko, who's the great military genius, you see no battle scene here. Why is it that when Schick painted this, who had studied and learned all of American history while he was in Europe and had painted a whole series of George Washington and the American Revolution, 38 paintings he painted of Washington and the American Revolution even before he came to America. How is it then he paints Kosciuszko here without a battle scene, even though he did paint here West Point, which he was a founder of? There is no battle scene here. And that is because Schick wants to teach us and emphasize something else. What is it? It's this document which is being held by Kosciuszko in his hand. What's it say? It turns out that when Kosciuszko was returning back to Poland for his second and final time, which was in the late 18th century, 1798, he actually wrote his last will and testament. And Schick has painted that here because it's the words that he wants us to know. Turns out that Kosciuszko had earned equivalent of about $15,000 in the service of America in Washington's army. And in his last will and testament, he says to his good friend, Thomas Jefferson, whom he writes here in the document, I want you to have all of my money as I return back to Europe. And with that money, I want you to take it, and I want you to purchase the emancipation of all of your slaves, and I want you to set them free. And that is Kosciuszko's last will and testament. That's what Schick wants to emphasize, that slavery was wrong in the 18th century and before that and in the 1930s. And I suspect that when these original works of art or someone has a chance to talk about them in 2011, Schick was hopeful that people would reflect on that message and bring it into their own lives in their own day and take a look around them. So here you have two of those paintings that were exhibited at the Polish Pavilion at the World's Fair in New York in 1939, at the very time that World War II broke out. But Schick was also an illustrator of books. He illustrated close to 30 books during his lifetime. This is one of them, Andersen's Fairy Tales. Some of you may have seen this book, or may have held it in your hands as a child, but you may not have remembered who the artist was. Well, he's Arthur Schick, and this is the most republished of any illustrated edition of Andersen's. Look, here you have the Snow Queen here, and then here you have, in a children's book, here you have his political art. You notice the similarities. And in style, this one work is called Satan Leads the Ball. Here he's followed by Hitler here and Goebbels here and Goering here and the Vichy French who are here and Mussolini. By the way, Mussolini doesn't have any pants on over here. And he's carrying the Nibelungen. Satan is carrying the Nibelungen in his hands, Wagner's music. And these are all the figures who would have danced at Satan's ball. I'm showing you this here, telling you a little bit about it as I move into children's books, but I wanted you to understand, see the sort of similarity of style as Schick applies his illuminations to caricature and cartoon and miniatures, children's books. And here are some of the illustrations from Andersen's. You see the King, Queen of Roses, the old street lamp. I love this. I think it has personality. Maybe I'm reading a lot of that into it, but I like it. And here you see the girl who trod on a loaf. And I can't tell you how many times I meet people who tell me they were frightened as children by some of the real the monsters that appeared in his fairy tales. Well, they're frightening anyhow. And, of course, he illustrated Canterbury Tales. These are some of the delightful Canterbury Pilgrims, among the 25 or so illustrations for Canterbury Tales published by the Limited Editions Club in New York after the war was over. And biblical books. He illustrated the Book of Job, the Book of Esther. Here you see the frontispage for the biblical book of Ruth, published by the Limited Editions Club in an edition of under 2,000 copies, but still limited, and each copy is signed, and these all can be purchased on the internet. They're fairly reasonable if you choose to go there. You can also buy a trade edition, I think, for like $20 or $25, so his books are available. And he illustrated Arabian Nights Entertainments, over 70 paintings for the Arabian Nights. And his Passover Haggadah, which is his great magnum opus among illustrated Jewish books, a work that he spent the years 1934 to 36 working on in Poland. These are some of the illustrations from that book. Here you see where he's painted. There are four sons, the wise, the simple, one who does no ask, and the wicked son. Schick even painted the wicked son here with a very Hitler-like mustache. And these are the questions that are recited by the youngest child. And here you see a large Hebrew letter with little vignettes. Here's baby Moses here, the Exodus, and the Egyptians drowning in the sea. And by the way, Schick, when artists were called upon in the Middle Ages to illuminate a manuscript, you'd have the artist who would do the art and the calligrapher, scribe, who would do the text. Schick did both. This is the dedication page. I don't know, how many of you saw the movie The King's Speech? Or at least, yeah, saw The King's Speech or saw the Academy Awards that announced it. Actually, Schick dedicated his Passover Haggadah to that very same king, King George VI of England. in which he wrote, "At the feet of your most gracious majesty, I humbly lay these works of my hands, showing forth the afflictions of my people Israel." And Schick signed this, Arthur Schick, Illuminator of Poland, because at that time he was worried about Poland in light of the Nazi threat in Europe. At the end, there's another dedication page which he signs his name, Arthur Schick, Painter of Israel. I need about an hour to talk about this one piece, but I don't have it, so I'm going to pass. If you want to come back to it later, we'll talk about why this book, which talks about the Exodus, the enslavement and by the ancient Egyptians and the Exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, how Schick is showing you here that this is a story about the Exodus of contemporary Jews, of European Jews, out of Europe in an attempt to get to the land of Israel, which he paints here on the British castle gates. And in between them stands a British military ship that prevents them from going there. But there's a whole story with this page, and is so filled with great symbolism. Again, St. George slaying the dragon, and the symbolism at the top. Playing cards, Schick manufactured. Schick created kings and queens and jacks, kings of ancient Israel, Saul, David, Solomon, Hezekiah, maybe known to some of you. And I'm actually having fun because I'm going to be manufacturing playing cards of Schick so people can actually have his cards and have fun with them. I don't have much time to go into detail on this, but this is the height of his illuminated manuscript technique. This is the Statutes of Kalisz. Statutes are laws. Kalisz was a town in Poland where in the 13th century, the king of Poland, Boleslav the Pious, granted civil and religious privileges to the Jews in Poland. It was the most tolerant place for Jews to live in all of Europe. They were being expelled from Germany, from France, later from England. Jews flocked to Poland, and they granted them the civil and religious privileges. Schick painted them, illustrated them, to show those friendly relations that existed between Poland and its minorities in the 13th century, reaffirmed in the 14th, 15th century. Why did he paint these in Paris in the late 1920s? Because he hoped that those same liberties and freedoms which were established and given to minorities, and particularly to the Jews in those centuries, would be accorded to them in Europe in light of the oncoming, the rising anti-Semitism and the Nazi threat which exhibited. Schick finished these works and traveled them to 14 cities in Poland. They were actually published in 1932 in Munich. Hitler came to power in 1933. Schick also finished a whole series of paintings dealing with George Washington and the American Revolution and freedom. He finished those in Paris, and in 1932, these works on freedom were published in Vienna. And these are also works by Arthur Schick, a self-portrait of his wife, Julia. Again, she appears here in 1924. I'm going back in time chronologically. And here you see a tale of Susanna and the elders. Now, Rembrandt and others also painted this tale, but Schick loved these miniatures from this Paris period in the 20s. Here you see one of his earliest watercolors, 1920. He had just finished being director of art propaganda for Poland, and he learned all these Russian legends. This story of Ivan Tsarevich, the I should be a T, and the story of the gray wolf is here. Here you find Saul and David. This is a miniature. This stands only this high. Now, that's too high. It's like this. And this is one of his sketchbooks from his Krakow period. You'll notice that Schick here is, he's only 19 years old, but already he's aware of, he sees the teachers of the academy like soldiers who are standing on a horse where the government or the school only wants the students to stand at ease at their easel and all paint the same thing. So it's sort of rebellion. This is from his own personal, this is the page. This is the work on that page. This whole page is less than 8.5 by 11, so you can imagine how small this is. I've blown it up here, and here you see Schick feeling that his teachers are like soldiers who are monitoring the art while everybody produces the same thing. And this is from the cover of his sketchbook in Paris when Schick is a 16-year-old. You'll see here two figures before a gravestone, sort of. And memento mori, symbols of death here, a skull with a knight's hat, a helmet, a sword running through it, a gargoyle here, 1910-11, Schick's initials here, and the well here. I found the picture on the internet today, and This is sort of outside the Cluny, near the church and in the courtyard. And this was the cover of his sketchbook as a teenager in Paris. Also in Paris, this is another work of his, where you see a man serenading a woman from the balcony. He's got his megaphone here, or his Victrola. Up comes the music. Her scarf is blowing. He's got his mustache, and there are planes over here, and having a great time, and chicks fooling around as a teenager. Here's my last work of art for you, and it is a sketch. And the reason I wanted to conclude with this is because here you see a pencil sketch, and almost as if the face comes alive here. So you might begin to think this is how he worked. He did a pencil sketch, and then he started to fill in the faces and finish it out. But the fact of the matter is that oftentimes he'd do a sketch, and he would leave the faces for last. And oftentimes he'd do no pencil sketch. So some of the great pieces that you saw here of the Illuminations, oftentimes there's no pencil under drawing. And the question is, how long did it take him to do these? These works of art, some of the most magnificent illuminated works, sometimes most of the time took him as long as 1 week. So almost all of his work was done very quickly, almost did no sketches or no preparatory works for them, didn't create 100 works before he got to the final one. He just took a piece of paper or a board, worked in watercolor and gouache, pen and ink on paper, never worked in oils, never worked on canvas. He was a miniaturist. And here you see some of the detail that comes alive. And I hope that in the course of this presentation, I was able to bring Arthur Schick alive for you even more and to educate you about this great artist and this great man. So thank you very much.
His comments today. Thank you so much. And we have lots and lots of questions. I'm just getting my lavalier mic on. So I appreciate you showing us all of those gorgeous pieces and talking about him. So how did you become interested in Arthur Schick?
Okay, so I'm going to make that pretty quick. How did I become interested in Schick? And that is when I needed gifts for people in my wedding party some 30-some years ago, I found reproductions of one of his books in a bookstore. The colors jumped out at me, and the price was right, so I bought it. And then years later, I saw 13 years, more than almost 15 years later, I saw some pieces in an antique shop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, some reproductions under a counter. I dusted off the box, the pieces came up alive, and I said, oh, this is the same artist I remember from when I got married. And then I kept calling, and I gave more and more interest in Arthur Schick, and then I spent an awful lot of money on something. I'll tell you how much money I spent. My wife is here. Please close your ears, Margie. So I went and I bought a work of art of Arthur Schick, and I paid $12,000, and I didn't know really who this artist was. And it was a reproductions. It was a limited edition book. It wasn't even original art. And then I went into libraries, and I said, I better learn who this is. It's sort of backwards, you know, you buy it. Then I went to learn. And the more I learned, it was those images I saw, the statute of Kalisch, those 13th century laws and that Schick had illustrated, illuminated in the 20s. And then I learned about him, and then I convinced a museum in Chicago to have an exhibit. And they said they would have an exhibit. It verified for me that somebody else validated what I believed was true, that this artist was worth showing, and that was the first of many exhibits. But that's the beginning. That was the beginning.
Okay. What do you think drew you to him specifically? Why do you think you were captivated by him?
So I'm captivated by Schick for two reasons. A, because I love his art, and I don't have an art historical background, and I'm not an artist. I love his art, and I love his messages. And that's what draws me to him, the art and the man. And what do I mean by his messages? This was an artist who fought against injustice and tyranny for justice and freedom his entire life. Schick was once asked in 1942, when he was fighting against the Nazis and the Axis, and he was fighting on behalf of the rescue of the Jewish people of Europe, he was asked by a newspaper reporter, if the war wasn't going on and you didn't have to worry about Hitler in Europe, what would you be doing with your time? And he responded, he said, I would devote my life to the enfranchisement and the dignity of the black man in America. That was an immigrant, a Polish Jewish immigrant in America in 1942. He'd been here only 2 years. And I guess it's because he cared so much about his own people and he has used its value system to be an advocate for humanity at large. I mean, he raised money during the war years for the Chinese and for the Czechs and for the Poles and the Greeks and the tattered Brits and the soldiers of Australia and New Zealand. He had exhibitions and he raised money and he gave his art and his time for the British American Ambulance Corps. Eleanor Roosevelt was very friendly with him. I mean, this is what he devoted his life to. So I'm drawn to him because I love his art and believe in it, and also because this is a man who cared deeply about himself and his own tradition and used it to help make the world a better place, to be an advocate for humanity. And what that tells me is that everybody should care about themselves and their own people and use the best of that tradition to make the world a better place. And that's what drives me about Arthur Schick. And, you know, but the world is so visual now, you just need to put a picture on the front page of the New York Times or on TV, and everybody, you don't have to read a book. You don't have to do anything. You just see a picture and you already believe it, even if the picture is made up, even whatever it is, if the image is there. So I believe that Schick's visual images offer us an insight if one studies them with the care that they deserve. You know, to call him the greatest artist since the 16th century is no flattery. If you really study his art and give it the attention it deserves, and you'll see. So, I'm not passionate about this at all.
So on that note, his works were in Collier's, Cosmopolitan. I mean, they were in major
all over,
publications.
All over.
How is it, and you touched on this, but we've had a few questions from the audience. Yeah. I'd love to delve into it. How is it that he's not, that only three people in the room
know? Yeah, how is it that people haven't heard of him? Or, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, it's his art on the front cover of Time magazine. You know, by the way, when Roosevelt gave his Four Freedoms speech in January of 1941, you know, before America's in the war, he gives his Four Freedoms speech, and 38 paintings of Arthur Schick dealing with freedom are hanging in the White House. So, I mean, this is a man who was well-known, and he was decorated by France. He was given the Palme Académique for serving as ambassador in Morocco and Poland for his service on behalf of humanity. And America gave him the George Washington Bicentennial Medal when he came here in 1934 for 6 months. They decorated him and had an exhibit at the Library of Congress at that time. How is it a man like this is forgotten? And Zilda Anderson's fairy tales keeps being reproduced, and his Passover Haggadah continues to be reproduced. How do we forget? You know, I'm standing by this mic. I'm trying to talk into it. And you know what? I'm not even using this mic. I'm using something over here. I can't figure this out. I don't know. Well, why he's forgotten is probably a combination of things. First of all, Schick was not part of any school of art. If you look at his art, it's not, you can't put him into any school, even though he knew German Expressionism, even though he knew medieval illuminations, caricature, cartoon, Slavic and Polish folk art. His art, he was aware of many styles, and yet he's unique. And I bet when you leave here, if you see Arthur Schick, you're never going to confuse him with any other artist. But because you can't put him into any school of art, you know, what are you going to do with a man like that? Who's going to write about him and say he influenced this one? There's no school of Schick. So people, and after the war, people have no one to place him. And after the war died, who was interested in illuminated manuscripts? I mean, it's already anachronistic. It's already 400 years old. Or who's interested in realism? It became a world of abstract modernism, and this was not a world that was drawn to the art of Arthur Schick. Also, if you see Szyk, how do you pronounce it? I mean, if you can't say a person's name, you're introduced to someone whose name is Krasinski, and I am. I may have difficulty pronouncing it. Sometimes it's hard to remember. I make every effort to try to pronounce those names and say them, but oftentimes we don't remember names. After he died, his family dismissed the dealers who were working with him. There were no dealers, and then Schick's son, George, died suddenly. So you had no dealers and no family representing him. So you weren't promoting his art. He wasn't part of any school of art. His style wasn't really the style that was part of the art world at the time. And he died at age 57 of a heart attack after he had been investigated by the House on Un-American Activities. Wow. Lost commissions. And that was when he was creating his greatest Americana. That's when he illustrated the Declaration of Independence in 1950. And Schick was already named to be a member of 7 subversive organizations in 1949. I have the pamphlet with Albert Einstein and others. His name is there. But Schick was not a communist. Schick was a great lover of America. He illustrated in 1949-50 the Bill of Rights, the Four Freedoms Prayer. And on July 4th, 1950, in New Canaan, Connecticut, the marching band came down the street, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts on either side, and he's being hailed as a citizen a citizen of the free world, as a soldier in art for America.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I was wondering about that. He was so lauded and appeared in all these great things, but he was saying things at the time, you know, in support of minorities or in support of certain things that I can imagine got the attention of.
Yeah, and, you know, and his home was filled with people who were coming, artists were coming by, and people in theater and Broadway were always coming to the Schick home in the evenings. And these were the people, and the people were being investigated and looked at. Schick's home was a household, a place for people to gather. Who, after Saturday night, you know, he was friendly with Edward G. Robinson, Stella Adler, and Marlon Brando was in one of the performances that Schick was an artist for, and so on. I mean, he knew all of these people, and they all knew him. Everyone knew. Why is he forgotten? Well, let me just, I don't know. He's not going to be forgotten again. Just not again.
I have a question. The same thing, but in Poland. So he was in Poland up until 1941?
He was in Poland until 1937, uh-huh. And from Poland he went to London, and he was in London from 1937 to 40. His son was fighting for the Free French at the time under De Gaulle, and Schick was in England, though, until 1940. Came to America, he went to Canada, then to America.
Okay. So I was wondering how his works were received as Hitler was gaining power.
I have scrapbooks. It's filled. People. He was famous. I mean, I can't imagine. When he came to a short visit in America in 1934 for a few months, everybody was at the docks. It was December. It was cold out. And I have the pictures. And his wife is in this fur or whatever. And it's freezing in December. And they're right there waiting for Schick to come off the boat. And they're taking photographs. I have the newspapers with his picture. Famous artist arrives from Europe. And in 1940, in Canada and the United States, art mobilized, says great Polish painter. And he's thorough. And the more you read and you go into it, this man was known by everybody. And, you know, even the GIs, you know, there's a Esquire magazine did a survey. And they said that his art was more popular with the GIs under the Selective Service Act than were pinups. People carried them and for inspiration when they were fighting. And you know what? His art was exhibited over 500 USO bases. Every GI who went overseas saw Schick's art in an exhibition.
Wow.
Everywhere.
That's amazing.
I haven't taken a breath yet. Excuse me. Okay.
So I'm wondering, he was conscious of his goals. He was conscious of...
He was conscious all the time of what he did. He was very aware of what he did. He was very aware, and yet he was and inside he was a hater of hate. I mentioned that before. But on the outside, he was jovial. He loved people. He loved to entertain. He loved to tell jokes, and loved his three grandchildren. In fact, with regard to his oldest granddaughter, he said that the only dictatorship I will ever accept is that of my granddaughter.
So I'm wondering. You've gone through these works with us and really pointed things out, and his works were very small and very detailed. Who deciphered his works at the time? How did people know the meanings behind these works?
You know, when Schick's art appeared in a series of eight paintings in Esquire magazine, the paintings would appear there, no commentary. That was the article. Oftentimes his art appeared with articles as illustrations to go with an article, but oftentimes his art was the article itself, and people would recognize Goebbels and Goering. They were more sensitive to the subtleties.
Sure, sure.
He rarely was writing about his art to give you insight, but the Collier's cover of Hitler and the historic poker game with Ivan of Russia, he's Ivan because America's it's Uncle Sam and England's John Bull, this is Ivan of Russia. Schick wrote about that. I mean, he went into detail what was going on, but he rarely decoded his own images.
Okay. So one audience member wants to know, so these works were beautiful and stunning and disturbing, and though people knew who he was and he was famous, why were the warnings not heeded?
Schick would create in 1940, he did a piece that was published in the American Mercury, you know, Mencken's magazine, although Mencken wasn't there at that moment when these are coming out, a picture of the Statue of Liberty holding up, instead of the torch, holding up a swastika. This would be one of Schick's works that was appeared. Or Schick would do a piece of Hitler sitting on the throne with Uncle Sam and John Bull in chains. And with all of his cronies around him and the Untermensch, the Jew at his feet. And this was called A Madman's Dream. And that appeared in Cornet magazine. That's like the size of Reader's Digest, you know. And that was in 1940, before America entered the war. Schick was showing America that if they didn't pay attention, what was in store for them.
So I have a question for you. Why wasn't Mussolini wearing any pants?
Why was Mussolini not wearing any pants? And the reason is because Schick saw Mussolini really as a very foolish guy. I mean, and he didn't go after him in the same way that he'd go after, let's say, even the Japanese in his art, you know, during the war years, or the Nazis as he depicted them in very grotesque ways. So, I mean, you know, his was propaganda art. It was used to, you know, Schick used to say all art is propaganda, even that from ancient Egypt and religions. And Schick felt that there was a message that needed to be delivered, and so he chose different figures to influence people by portraying them in their own unique characteristic ways as he saw them. And so he did do stereotyping, and yet one needs to always look at that within the context in which he created the art.
So, of course, we have an audience member who asked, and I want to know as well, what happened at the Schick exhibit in Berlin after the war?
Okay, so maybe this is... Are our program scheduled to conclude at 7?
You know, it is. If you all don't mind, I'd love to keep you for a few minutes. I have just a few questions.
Okay, that's why I talk fast, because I always try to pack this in. I want to tell you something. I was traveling an exhibition to Poland in 2005, and I thought, you know what? I asked Marge, I said, would you mind if we go to Japan, to Berlin for a couple of days? I've never been there. And she said, yeah. So I sent emails to 30 museums in Berlin with the idea that if I got one back, wouldn't it be something if there was an exhibition of this, the leading anti-Nazi artist in America during World War II, which Schick was, wouldn't it be something if there was an exhibit of this artist in Berlin? I got no responses. We went to Berlin. Marge said, let's go visit the Deutsches Historisches Museum. This is the German Historical Museum. It's the most prestigious museum in Germany. When I knew it was a historical museum, I was in. We went there. We walked up to someone. I said, do you know who the director is? They said, oh, Dr. Hans Ademeyer. Second day, we went back, the last of our 2 days in Berlin. Marge walks into the exhibit. I walk into the front desk. I say, is there somebody here I could speak with from the director's office? They said, well, who are you? And I said, well, my name's Irvin Ungar. I'm from California. I'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in about 7 years from now. Can I see some? Can I talk to someone? So what happened was she said, just wait a few minutes. Somebody will speak with you. So I waited for a few minutes, and no one came. I went right back to the desk. I said, could you try again? And the lady tried again, and it turns out, and I sat down, and she tried again. She said, come over here. She says, you're not going to believe this. She says, the director of the German Historical Museum is on the phone. I said, oh, my God. You know, that's like you're going to the White House and saying, excuse me, I need to talk to Obama for a few minutes. Can I talk with him? That's what this was like. This man is like a Renaissance man, art, history. He's on the phone. I said, holy crap, I've got two. All right. I said, I've got two sentences to convince him to meet with me. I said these two sentences. He says, come on up. I'd like to meet with you. So I go up there. I go into his office. Where I'm like sitting here like this with him. He's sitting there. A round table in front of us. I never go anywhere without some reproductions of Schick's art. I put it on the table. He goes like this. Like this. This is great art, he says to me. Who is this artist? I said, this is Arthur Schick. He said, has he ever exhibited in Germany? And I said, oh, no, sir. He was, as I mentioned to you on the phone, he was the leading anti-Nazi artist in America during World War II. He never would have been exhibited in Germany. He said, just a minute. And the man comes through the door, and he says, take a look at this art. And he looks at the art, and the director, Dr. Ademeyer, looks up at, who turned out to be the head curator of that museum, and he says, you know, we should include this art in our next exhibition on Kunst und Propaganda, on art and propaganda. And I go, oh, my God, I just walked in off the street. I'm here 10 minutes, and I'm talking. You know, I try to call New York for an appointment with a museum. I can't get the secretary on the phone after 3 years. But here I am after 10 minutes. I'm talking to the director. Then he says, no. He says, we should do an exhibition of your artist himself. And I go, oh, man. Like this, he says, can you get me a proposal? I said, oh, yes, sir. And he said, you know, we should do a catalog of your artist. And he takes this thick book off. Margie, give me that, the German historical account. He puts this thick catalog that's on the table, and he says, and we should do a catalog of your artist in, bring that, give me that. He says, we should do a catalog of your artist in German and in English. And then he says to me, you know, we never did a catalog in English before. And it's this thick. He puts this on the table. I go, oh, my God. He said, send me a proposal. I sent Dr. Ottermeyer a proposal. 30 days later, I get a response back. Dear Mr. Unger, this is in 2005, I'm meeting with him. In the fall of 2008, we will have an exhibition of your artist in the Iampei building of the Deutsches Historisches Museum in 2008. And in August of 2008, I went to the opening of that exhibition. I served as the guest curator for that. But I'm sitting there at the opening. Members of the Polish embassy are playing music of a Holocaust survivor on the stage. Germans, Jews, everyone are in the audience. On my right is Dr. Hans Ottermeyer, and on my left is Arthur Schick's daughter, 80-some years old from Florida, who came in for the exhibition. I'm pinching myself, saying, oh, my God, I can't believe this is taking place. You talk about really, you know, all my year, you know, as an educator and involved in stuff, you know, teaching about things, and here we are, you know. And Arthur Schick's art against the background, I said, whoa, this is something. And, you know, I went back a second time to videotape young people in front of this and painting of, you know, the German people, sons of Cain, be you damned forever and ever. And I got German high school kids, 17 and 18-year-olds, standing with me in front of this thing. And I said to them, how does that make you feel? And the kids said to me, two of them actually at the same time, said, you know, this doesn't make us feel guilty, but it makes us feel responsible. You know, responsible that something like this doesn't happen again. And does that mean to every German high school kid that means thinks that, or every Polish high school kid, or every American high school kid thinks that? No, it doesn't. But at that moment in time, you know, these young people connected with this art, and it was as if Arthur Schick was, you know, speaking and communicating with them today. And that's my experience. That's my experience in Germany and in Berlin.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing that. Really appreciate it. So I have just a couple more questions for you. Somebody wants to know, is there a Schick Museum yet?
There's an Arthur Schick Society in Burlingame, and I'm its in-kind curator, and there's some newsletters that you can take. They're free over there. And you can go to schick.org or schick.com and see about Schick on the Internet. Okay. Yeah.
And also, when is the exhibit at the Contemporary Jewish
Museum? Oh, there's going to be a Schick exhibit here in San Francisco next February. And it will be, you'll see original art, not the same art that was at the Legion of Honor, different art. And it'll be next February at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. I think it's going to run for a few months. And I was told I'm the guest curator. We haven't sat down to do a few things yet, but we will. And it'll happen. And sometimes things move a little more slowly, but that's next February.
And do you have plans for any sort of biography of Mr. Schick?
There is a wonderful biography that's already been written by a man named Joseph Ansell, A-N-S-E-L-L. Joe spent 20 years on it. It's called Arthur Schick, Artist, Jew, and Pole. And it's a wonderful biography. Joe has written it, and Joe unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but his legacy of this book is great. It's a great book.
And I'm so sorry. There were so many more wonderful questions, but we've reached the point where we should probably close things up. So I want to thank Erwin Unger, founder and CEO of Historicana and curator for the Arthur Schick Society. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Gina Bellaria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you for coming.